Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Raimi Avard to the broadcast. Raimi is the Chief Information Officer of the Novartis Institute for Biomedical Research, or NIBR, Novartis's global pharmaceutical research organization. The informatics organization in NIBR is responsible for scientific application and scientific infrastructure, as well as any research-specific IT activities and all aspects of information technology infrastructure, platforms, and services. Before joining Novartis, Raimi was the CIO for Argonne National Laboratories, a 4,000-person U.S. Department of Energy open science research laboratory operated by the University of Chicago. His emphasis there was on operation of all aspects of the IT infrastructure, including security, and the development and maintenance of all business applications. He also led teams of computer scientists, helping to design and build the fastest supercomputers in the world for open science. Raimi has been an active member of the international high-end computing and networking community for 20 years. He also serves on the board of multiple organizations, including USENIX and Prime. Raimi received an MS in computer science from the University of Oregon and undergraduate degrees in computer science and mathematics from Andrews University. I recently caught up with Raimi at the NIBR offices in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and our conversation covered Principle 1, people, as we discussed Raimi's transforming a dysfunctional organization into a high-performing one, Principle 2, infrastructure, as we discussed Raimi's approach to knowledge management solutions, Principle 3, project and portfolio management, as we discussed his approach to governance in a research organization with a vast portfolio of projects, as well as some other topics. Well, Raimi Avard, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thanks.
Excellent. Raimi, maybe you can begin by explaining Novartis Institutes for Biomedical Research for those who might not be so familiar with it. What exactly is the organization and what is your role in it?
Sure. So Novartis is one of the large pharmas. It's about 100,000 people. I think we lose track, 110,000, 120,000, in about 100 countries around the planet, which is an interesting place. And NIBR, which is what we call it, the short version for that, is the research organization for Novartis. So it's actually interesting from an organizational standpoint. Novartis, as a company about 6 years ago, made a strategic decision, which no other pharmas have done that I'm aware of, to take research and actually organizationally separate it from the development organization, make it its own business unit. So inside of Novartis, we have about 5,000 to 6,000 people inside of the research organization, NIBR, and then we have pharma, and then we have four or five other business units. So I tend to think of all of those, they're their own business unit. Novartis is the parent company, and research is the law center.
I see.
Right. So our mission is to discover drugs and to take them to the point where they've been tested inside of a human being. At that point, they've been proven to be efficacious. They work, but then they have to be turned into something that doesn't damage people and can be sold and so on. It transitions at that point into our development organization. The core of the organization is about science. Right? We're doing science, trying to discover things, bring it to the point where it works, which means it's a really different kind of culture that you're looking for.
Yeah.
Right. So this is a 5,000, 6,000 person global scientific discovery organization. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Right. My role, I'm the CIO for that organization globally.
Yes.
So I'm responsible for the IT components, which includes both infrastructural kinds of things, networks, desktops, and so on that we do with our corporate partners, as well as all the informatics supporting the different kinds of scientific activities, and then partnering with scientists inside of those areas, inside of research, who are really specialists in their particular area, right?
Okay.
So it's a really challenging, interesting role.
It does sound like a very challenging one. And from what I've learned from you, when you joined the organization, you joined a relatively dysfunctional IT department. And the challenges that you've given yourself and your team is to turn it into a highly asset-driven organization. And I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about that journey and where you currently stand in that journey.
Yeah, sure. So unfortunately, when research was carved out of the rest of pharma and turned into its own division, like I said, about 6 years ago, and it was built up in Cambridge at that point as the headquarters for it, it wasn't organized in such a way that IT had a strong voice at the leadership table.
I see.
So the organization grew as part of the Novartis strategic investment in research,
but
it didn't grow in a way that IT could keep up with it. And this led to an organization, in fact, it didn't even quite exist centrally, where people were scrambling for IT resources here and there and doing different things and created all kinds of legacy complicated systems. And some parts were working and some parts weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided about 4 years ago to create a CIO function, bring together most of the scientific IT components together, create one organization and make it globally responsible for all of IT for research, and to put a CIO in charge of that. And then they eventually found me. I don't have a background in biology. I don't have a background in chemistry. I'm a computer scientist. I've built some of the fastest computers on the planet. I came here because I was interested in the global nature of it, because of the scientific discovery and because of the mission of helping, you know, cure patients, which is really motivating. And walking in, I discovered this was an IT organization that really hadn't been led in a way that needed to be done, and hadn't been connected into the mission of what we were trying to do in research. Mm-hmm. Right. So the challenges there were identifying the priorities. Boy, it wasn't too hard to find those. Everybody and their dog wants something from us. and trying to figure out how to line that up with really a very under-resourced and under-directed organization and try to figure out how to do that. Yep. And this is now, we're now 3 years into it.
Okay.
So, you know, I want to go back and take notes and figure out what we've gone through. But the first year was really about listening to the scientific side of the organization and trying to understand what their top requirements are, as well as those things we could turn around quickly, right? And to quite quickly reach into the IT organization globally, identify who could step in, who could make some differences, try and get some quick wins on the table because, I mean, you know this, you've seen this elsewhere. The first thing you have to do is get enough credibility that people start listening to you.
Yes, exactly. Right?
So we started delivering on a few things here and there that had already been in the pipeline, but maybe didn't have quite enough emphasis on them. Turned those around, got a little bit more support. And interestingly enough, the organization here, I mean, we're a research organization. It's all about scientific data and scientific knowledge. IT, informatics are core to what we do. And the organization knows that. Mm-hmm. So there's a great hunger for functional IT. You know, not just go away and leave us alone and solve our problems, but we want you to dig in, help us make this stuff work. Mm-hmm. And so once we had a little bit of credibility and a little bit of motion going, that began to carry us forward.
I see.
So the first year we delivered a number of things, structured ourselves. This was really key, such that we had the traditional IT model when I walked in, which was we had this sort of account management team that went around trying to create demand and come up with projects to do. And then they handed it off to an engineering team who did stuff. And that team handed it off to a support organization that tried to hold it together. And it wasn't working. The dynamics were all messed up. And so the account managers were creating way too much stuff to do that the project managers didn't know what was coming at them. And the support organization didn't want to take care of anything. And sort of a traditional pipeline when you understand your area. We took it and said, no, there's way too much variability in our project space. Some things we can do in a week. Some things take years to do. Mm-hmm. We have to understand the domain deeply. And there's a huge difference between the chemistry side of the organization and the biology side of the organization and, you know, the interaction with the clinical side. So I created small teams of, say, 4 to 10 people responsible globally to each of the internal organizations inside of the research. So one responsible to chemistry, one responsible to screening. And basically I said to the manager of that team, your job is to go out and make them happy with the resources that you have and start with what you can do and we'll build into what they really need that we can't do yet. Right. So that led to the quick win strategy. And then in the second year, because of the progress in the first year, we were able to bring in more resources, add some people to it. And that year, I began to build a leadership team. And by the end of the second year, we'd identified people elsewhere in the industry and elsewhere outside of the industry who could come in, who knew either how it's been done in other pharmas or knew the right way of bringing in innovative software engineering or really had the right approach to infrastructure to pick up pieces. So in the transition from year two to year three, we went from me having something like 25 direct reports to more like 6 direct reports, which is where we are now, which is a slightly more rational lifestyle. Right. And the interesting transition there from an IT perspective is, well, we've kept all the projects moving forward and we've kept delivering on them. And from an end user standpoint, they haven't seen any difference. What's changed fundamentally is that we're now considerably more confident in our direction. We're making critical decisions about this is our architecture. This is not our architecture, which is just as important.
Exactly.
This is the approach that we're going to take to doing project management and methodology. This is the direction that we're going for social networking. And while some of those haven't happened in a way that the end users can see it, they're shaping what we're doing now, right? Which then gives us even more inertia for delivering in the future.
I see.
Right. And that's, I think, probably the most fundamental change in terms of bringing in leadership who knows what they're doing.
I see. You mentioned at the outset that you are not somebody with an industry background. You're a computer scientist,
right. Obviously
an autodidact and a curious person to boot, which probably helped you come up the learning curve here internally. But to what extent does it require building a team that does have that scientific background to be able to speak, to have the right terms, have the right aspects in mind as they're dealing with a highly intelligent business community here?
It matters a great deal.
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. So one of our key hires was Patrick Warren, who is a PhD, a former biochemist, who, you know, as I like to say, he fell to the dark side somewhere in his career, and now he understands IT. And he's here because he's passionate about the science, and he knows how to translate the needs of scientists into IT projects that make sense. Mm-hmm. And then that transitions into our software engineering organization, where people don't have a scientific background. Mm-hmm. They have a software expertise background. But that translation is really important. Yes. And most of our project teams have somebody with a PhD and somebody who really knows code deep. Mm-hmm. Right? And if it's an outsourced kind of project, it's somebody who knows how to manage vendor relationships.
Yeah.
So it's a collection of skills, but it's all about how you deliver on the science and the understanding of the need of the science.
Yes.
And in fact, it's a place where we struggle, because I think the most valuable kind of IT organization is one that can step into a complicated interaction problem space, look at it and say, we have an idea on how to address this problem in ways that you guys don't understand, mm-hmm. but we know how to bring tools to bear that will change how you work, mm-hmm. which is really different from taking orders.
Yes.
And you can't bring that kind of insight if you don't understand what's happening at the bench and what's happening in people's heads as they're trying to come to make decisions here.
I see. So it sounds like you're transitioning much more to a consultative model as opposed to simply an order-taking model.
I would say that's a goal.
Okay.
Right. We have some of both, but that's definitely aspirational in some spaces.
Okay. Well, you talked a lot about the plan today. Can you speak a little bit more about the plans for the foreseeable future?
It's interesting. 2 years ago, we were really struggling to shape the roadmap and build the team. Mm-hmm. And we had all kinds of problems left and right. And now it's more, we know what we're doing is execute.
Yes.
Get it done,
right,
to get to the next stage.
Yes.
But we're going through a turnaround where we're trying to replace considerable amounts of legacy software, get the right kinds of things in place. And so the collection of things that we're executing on are meant to deliver basically a functional scientific IT environment, mm-hmm. up and down from infrastructure all the way to the UI.
I see.
And so of those, the most important one is something that we call the data initiative. And this goes to looking at 10, 15 years of legacy data, what's being created in the labs, what's being put into the lab notebooks, and saying we're not capturing the right kinds of information. We're not being able to compare what we've done in one place with what we do in another place. We have to bring in a highly structured data environment that all of the software out there can build into and build on, but it also has to support unstructured data at the same time, mm-hmm. right? Our organization exists to create data and understand it.
Yes.
Right? And so that has been ignored for a long time here. Mm-hmm. We've seen other places in pharma where research has addressed that in various ways. We think not quite as comprehensively as what we're talking about here. So this is like a 5-year initiative, and we're in about year 2 of it. And that's beginning to come together. That's the number one thing. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, half the organization in the science space gets it and knows this is incredibly important. It will change how we work. Mm-hmm. The other half is like, why are you even bothering me with the data? I care about this other thing. They don't want to deal with it.
Right, right.
Right. But there's no question this will fundamentally change how we work if we get it right.
Obviously, it's a very complex environment, and I would imagine a natural tendency as IT is supporting a very innovative community to sort of let some of these ideas go off and run. Whereas also, on the other hand, given the number of disease areas you're supporting, the number of technologies and infrastructure that you have within your purview to institute a good amount of governance. How do you deal with that sort of creative tension of governing but also allowing enough liberty to make sure that innovation is happening the right way and at the right pace?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. So the factors in governance, before answering your question straight up. So the first bit is that we don't have what I tend to think of as traditional IT projects where we're adding yet another component to some big ERP system.
Right, right.
When we go into a project, we often have no idea what it's going to take to deliver on it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this has driven us to a very agile methodology. We actually have a collection of different ones under an adaptive framework, mm-hmm. where we iterate as opposed to trying to get requirements up front. We get a base thing and we iterate until it's done.
Okay.
Okay. Now that drives the finance side of the company crazy, because we don't know how much a project is going to cost before we start it. And then how can you do planning? And this mm-hmm. is a problem. Mm-hmm. Some places we can plan, mm-hmm. some places we simply can't. And that's because the user requirements change as fast as the IT systems do. And the other component of the governance that factors in is that we are by no means, and you alluded to this, we're by no means the only IT experts in the company. Exactly. Every one of them out there can program, and some of them can program really well. And so part of our mission is to provide enough of an underlying data and software environment that people can take advantage of that and use that to build quicker and more effective decision systems for their space.
Yes.
So we've taken an approach, for example, of not trying to kill the so-called shadow IT organizations. We are the central IT organization in research, but there are a number of informatics organizations that are part of different parts of the science spaces that specialize in their areas, and there's programmers here and there. We bring them in when they make sense to be part of central IT, but we're not trying to be on top of everything. That kingdom building thing just doesn't make sense. We're trying to enable.
Yes.
So we've built a community. Okay. That's led to a really, well, it looks more like an academic governance model in some ways than a more industrial strength governance model. So your classic governance model, and I've lived in this situation in the past, is you have a committee of people who represent different parts of the business. You prepare a collection of project proposals for the upcoming year, or maybe it's every 3 to 6 months. You have them pretty well scoped out. You put all the projects on the table, and then people duke it out, and they get their favorite one in, and some get yes, and some get no. And theoretically, you're choosing the most important projects for the organization for the upcoming period of time, and those are the ones blessed. Mm-hmm. In my experience, many times you're doing some kind of dickering back and forth, and it may not be the most important one that gets selected, mm-hmm. right? The other governance model is the CIO picks them all, and you just go do them, and you tell people, you know, to just go soak your head if you don't like it. that one doesn't work so well for the CIO typically in the long run unless you guess right. So the model of governance that we've put in place is it goes back to that, what I mentioned earlier, which is we have teams assigned to each part of the organization. Their mission is to make people happy, mm-hmm. all right? Make them productive, mm-hmm. which is really important, and do that in strategic ways wherever possible. So we build our governance model around having a functional relationship there, where those people are continually working with day-to-day with the bench scientists, with the leadership, so those parts of the organization, working out what the priorities are. They don't say yes or no. They talk about sequencing. Mm-hmm. What are we going to get to first with the resources that we have in our team? Mm-hmm. And then when we have bigger projects, larger than the scope of one particular organization, and those are increasing, by the way, as our organization becomes more capable, mm-hmm. We support those with a pool of project managers that we have in our project management organization, or a pool of software engineers or some of our outsource vendors for the larger scale projects. And we make decisions around those based on what appears to be the top priorities in the organizations and support of those from other parts of the science spaces. And when needed, we'll then bring it up to the leadership level of the top 7 or 8 people on the science side, along with me sitting down. But it's not an allocate resources and that one wins and that one doesn't as much as let's confirm these are priorities. Let's put them in a sequence order that makes the most sense. And then let's move them all forward and iterate quickly on what's in the portfolio.
I see.
So going into next year, I know what the top priorities are, but I guarantee you 6 months into it, we'll be working on different things in half the portfolio.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right. And this drives some people crazy, but we're getting a lot done in this space.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that sounds like a very dynamic environment, to say the least. Well, a lot of what you speak to points to the necessity of thinking through knowledge management in a very effective way. So much of what a research organization does in a pharmaceutical company naturally revolves around research and making sure that the wheel's not invented twice, and that research done in one part of the world can be shared, or best practices can be shared from one part of the world to the next. How does IT facilitate that process of making sure the scientists are being as effective as they can be?
That's one of the biggest challenges on our plate right now. Mm-hmm. So if you do the traditional split data, information, and knowledge into 3 different buckets, mm-hmm. and those are very overlapping buckets,
yes,
by
yes.
the way. One of the really interesting things I discovered when I came here, and I have not seen this elsewhere, although I'm positive it exists, is that everything we do builds into one collective data pool. Mm-hmm. So I don't have sales over here and marketing over here and engineering over here. And the systems that we build for engineering have almost nothing to do with finance except that there's some common cost center, mm-hmm. right? Most CIOs have a collection of projects that minimally relate to each other. Our entire collection of projects are related because our entire collection of scientists are building one large global mm-hmm. knowledge base, as you said,
yes.
right? Some experiment done in Pathways today may be important 5 years from now as it's transitioning into clinical, because they may have to come back and say, hey, what happened when we screened that particular compound against that particular protein? Mm-hmm. Right? And we do a lot of data mining, so you never know what's going to be important later.
Yes.
So it turns out everything we do relates to everything else that we do. And this goes back to the data initiative. Why we're doing this? Because yeah. it's not being captured in a way that's comparable. So you can do exactly the same test, assay as it's called, mm-hmm. in California and in Basel, exactly the same thing, and you can't compare them because they're using different naming standards and different approaches. And so we don't know what we know, right? We've learned this over here, but we can't share it in a useful way, which is insane. We
yeah.
exist as a large organization to build on our scale, and we can't do that because
right
of the data.
Yeah.
So in fact, we're going after the data now because it's the core problem. Mm-hmm. This challenge of global knowledge mm-hmm. is one that we've just barely begun to identify. So on the list of things coming up, I mentioned the data, but we also have social networking, which we might want to cover a little bit of,
yes,
and this,
absolutely.
How do we capture the knowledge and share it? One of the core questions we have is, how do you find somebody in our large organization who is the expert on something? How do they share what they know with the rest of the company in a way that scales and that works? If we can figure out how to capitalize on that, we're taking advantage of our scale as opposed to being sunk with our scale because of bureaucracy,
yes,
for
yeah.
example. And so we've just barely begun to tackle that knowledge question. Mm-hmm. And it's in part because we're getting the data in place, and it's part because we don't know how. So for the knowledge bits, we've begun to think, as an example of what we're exploring, every scientist keeps a lab notebook. Right, that's not only good scientific practice, but in our world, it's required because we use those for intellectual property purposes down the road.
Yes.
Sometimes we keep that electronically. Sometimes it's kept on paper. We're transitioning the entire organization over to the digital over the next couple of years. That's not trivial, as it turns out. Now, that's the first place where you have real knowledge capture. Mm-hmm. But then you want that to be shared across teams, so that somebody who observes something can share it with somebody else in their team, and then you can have the team identify what are the core pieces of information or knowledge coming out of that that are important for where that project is going. And sometimes that conclusion is really important to capture as it bubbles up, because it's a game-changing point in a project where it's going through a phase change or whatever else. Mm-hmm. So in essence, observations made at the bench in a lab notebook can be the kind of thing that you would want in an executive business intelligence report, or maybe at a point where you're in a transition, or maybe completely irrelevant. And we want to have some kind of way of flagging things and sharing them and adding value or an importance to them, so that they bubble up the organization to the part of the management chain that needs to be aware of something happening. And so this is partly a knowledge capture, knowledge synthesis kind of question. And we see a collection of standard existing technologies in place to help with that, but building on social networking in ways that we haven't seen yet, right, and building on BI and other areas that we think we could take advantage of. We don't know how that's going to play out. We've seen some prototypes here and there. It's something we're exploring now.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? How do you see the role of new technologies, Web 2.0 technologies especially, playing a role in helping facilitate that transition?
It's interesting on social networking because it's overhyped. You know, it's right up there with the cloud, right? What is it and what the value is of it? And I think both of those are going to go through your classic Gartner hype cycle and emerge on the other end having proven to be valuable. Mm-hmm. And the challenge with social networking is I don't know of any good enterprise platform for it yet. There's a lot of basic stuff. SharePoint's one of the obvious ones, but they're not there at the level that you would like. And it's different inside of an enterprise than it is out on the open internet. And so we've got a whole collection of internal grassroots activities going on. We've got a lot of SharePoint activities. We've got some, you know, various things we're exploring inside. But what we haven't figured out is how to adopt these at a fully enterprise scale in a way that makes us more productive. Mm-hmm. Right? So we're bringing in people who are experts in this. We're really tracking what other people are doing. We've got some stuff that I think will play out. But I would have to say it's one of the areas I'm excited about because, again, the potential of going from being 6,000 individuals to 6,000 people working together as an organization, there's nothing out there quite like this to be able to make that possible, right, where your scale becomes an asset.
Exactly.
Right.
So
and that's
dealing,
huge.
Dealing with that complexity that you were talking about, essentially making the organization a little bit smaller in some ways.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can see how it could work. It's a collection of internal blogging, internal wikis, text mining and analysis, all the stuff that everybody's using elsewhere.
Yes.
But we have to customize it to the domain we're in, which is about discovery, knowledge capture, and the underlying science behind it, which is changing radically.
Yes. As you talk about the going from paper-based notation to digital notation among the science community here at Novartis and at NIBR, does this require developing standard naming conventions? You talked about how there's different practices that are used in different parts of the world, perhaps even the same part of the world, but in different disease areas that may have relationships. Can you talk to me about helping to sort some of that out?
Yeah, it's tough. This has been something that the entire industry has been trying to tackle for a very long time.
I imagine, yeah.
Right, and genes have different names and get new ones all the time. So what you end up with is some kind of internal semantic strategy. Mm-hmm. So I guess at some highest level, there's two big bets going on in the industry. One is you can structure everything and you can put in hard-coded maps, in essence, ontologies and structured data names around creating a very structured environment where everybody puts everything into it and you pick the gene name that you like to go with.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the other extreme is the don't bother to organize anything, just create a really smart semantic search engine and let it go nuts, and it'll come to various conclusions. And we know companies that are going down both routes.
I see.
And we're fairly certain that success lies somewhere in between those, right? So we have this huge data initiative that I mentioned about structuring the data.
Yeah.
But on top of that, we have a semantic analysis strategy building on some of the expertise we've had in the company for years that's helping to understand things that might not otherwise be connected. So we have, for example, a massive synonym encyclopedia behind the scenes that says this. When you see this, it actually means this in this context. And we've invested fairly heavily in that for a number of years. And that's making a difference now.
That's excellent. Can you talk a little bit about NIDIS, the IT organization within NIBR? its relationship to IT within Novartis as a whole?
It's an interesting mix. So there, for every division that I mentioned, and there's about six business divisions, there is a CIO for those, and then there's a corporate CIO.
I see.
And Novartis is trying to walk that balance between having divisional independence and corporate synergies and cross-divisional coordination, as they call it. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is that the more you want to do cross-divisional things, the more the company leans toward a one-size-fits-all, you know, a standard whatever.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of standard whatevers, like a standard desktop and a standard network and so on. And the problem that we have with those is that they very rarely work in our part of the organization inside of research.
I see.
Because our world moves fast, because we have completely different challenges. And, I mean, we're 5% of the company and we own 50% of the data in terms of storage.
Wow.
Right? And computing. And so the challenge there is balancing between the cost savings that you'll get with a very standardized IT approach and the fact that we're focused on productivity and speed and delivery and sorting out the situations between those. And so what I try and do is when there's a corporate approach that makes sense for us to adopt, such as a common network and so on, absolutely, let's build on it and make that go.
Yes.
But where it makes a difference for productivity for research, I mean, we exist to get drug candidates into the clinic as fast as possible for patients and for the company.
Yes.
And IT has to support that as opposed to be in the way of that. Right. So there's a balance to be played there.
That makes sense.
Honestly, it's really funny. I have tons of conversations with my colleagues, the CIOs of the other divisions. And it's like we live in completely different worlds because, I don't do ERPs. I don't do customer relations. We don't have customers, right?
Right,
I don't
exactly.
do CRMs. I love this. I don't do the financial systems. Those are provided out of corporate.
Yes.
You know, I'm focused entirely on delivering things to scientists.
That's
so
great.
Occasionally there's like logistics kind of mm-hmm. things, you know, but otherwise it's like a different world. And so it's fun. Mm-hmm. All right. But sometimes it's a challenge.
Excellent. One last question. You've begun to talk about some of the new technologies that excite you, but I wonder if you can further look into your crystal ball to think about other new technologies, thinking a few years out that you particularly excite you for what you're doing at Nidus, but for the industry more generally speaking.
Well, I sort of lump those into two categories. There's ones that I would say are exciting for all of IT.
Yes.
And then there's ones that are exciting for us in science.
I see.
And on the ones that I'm excited about from all of IT, they're I would say the really obvious list that everybody's buzzing about. Mobile devices are changing how we work. I can't wait till this laptop is gone and it's replaced by a slightly smaller tablet. And this is because we have a lot of people who are mobile moving around the labs and so on. This can change how we work again.
Exactly.
And I think it's going to change us more than we think. Mm-hmm. Right. Cloud, I'm not as excited about because, we have huge storage challenges and putting our data in the cloud is like shoving it through a straw.
Mm.
And we have to see how that plays out. I'd love to see that change, you know, but the scaling up and down isn't a big demand for us. On the other hand, virtualization, we're all over that. And we've been doing a ton of that.
Exactly.
I think the collision between enterprise owned systems and enterprise owned information versus personally owned systems and personally managed information is happening. It's certainly happening in our world, you know, and so we're going towards the notion of everybody gets their own computer and they treat it like their brain augmentation device. But somewhere in there, we have to protect our intellectual property on that space. And how do we do that? That's a real struggle for us. There's some technology in that space that I think will be helping us, but I don't trust DRM to do what we want, right? So we have to see how that one works out.
Yes.
And then social networking I mentioned, right?
Exactly.
So those are all sort of more classical IT things. And I think all of those could fundamentally change how we work. Right. On the scientific side, the things that are really interesting are things like deep sequencing, which just change by orders of magnitude the amount of information you can get out of sequencing a gene. You can go from, in essence, the average of what you get from a collection of genes to that very specific interaction with that gene and that compound, for example. And that's blowing our data centers apart. It's challenging our ability to analyze the information coming out. And if we get it right, it'll be a competitive advantage in the science space for quite a while. Now, a lot of companies know that. Everybody's racing toward it. So it's, in some sense, the next technology, right? But if you look at that, if you look at automation moving to the nanoscale and what's going on, the data continues to explode. And therefore, the technologies I'm looking for are on the analysis side. The, oh my God, I have this huge amount of data. How do I understand stuff? And there we're exploring with some things I probably shouldn't mention in here, but I'm excited about a few of them. So that's a big one.
Excellent. Well, Ramy Varda, really appreciate you taking some time and speaking with us on the Forum on World Class IT.
Thank you.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people, doing the right jobs at the right time, it will be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure, defined as software, hardware, networks. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will likely become stuck in a reactive mode, constantly fighting fires. And if systems and hardware work reliably, on the other hand, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It's important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and quality assurance, through to support and all other aspects of the IT department, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business. Now, if the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy-setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming crucial to corporations, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metisstrategy.com. And please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metisstrategy.com. Our sound editor is Chris Davis, our web editor is Christian Dooley, and our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.